Hello, and welcome to episode 438 of The Crate and Crowbar, being recorded on the 24th of September. With me tonight to talk about some video games that we have been playing is Mr. Chris Thurston.
Hello. Sorry, I really overcommitted. I'm sorry. Can I take it back?
An equally overcommitted Marsh Davies.
Well met.
There you go.
And I, of course, am Jamie Britton.
Of course.
The best of all Jamies. Guys, hello. great Britain. Brexit Britain. Guys, what have you been playing? Ugh. I'm going straight in.
Okay.
It's Tuesday night. I'm in a creepy Airbnb in Warwick, and I don't give a fuck anymore. What have you been playing?
Okay.
No, women speak. Right.
This is not the venue. Should we back up a second? Sorry, that really threw me. Can we talk about Peglin? I know that we need to talk about Space Marine, and we will. We are going to. We can if you want. But I've spent the last 12 hours of my gaming life playing Peglin.
Yeah,
and I need to talk to someone about Peglin.
From tiny balls to Peglin.
This is what happens when we don't plan the intro. It's Bedlam.
Yeah, let's talk Peglin. Let's talk Peglin.
All right, let's Peggle. Peggle. So Peglin is a game by Red Nexus Games. It just left early access in Steam, which is why it kind of like floated into my queue. And I saw it and I was like, yes. And I said that to myself and with my money because it has a lovely little goblin, the Peglin of the title, the kind of pathos-laden little bopping pixel art goblinoid. And it's also a sort of deck-building, run-based kind of roguelike-y sort of game, a Slay the Spire-type deal or a Monster Train-type deal. But it's Peggle, which is to say it's pachinko, which is to say it is a game where you engage in turn-based combat with an array of little pixel art monsters where your turn is to fire a ball down a big old load of pegs. And what you achieve with that basically determines how much damage you do and kind of what other kind of debuffs you might bring to bear. And it layers tons of mechanics on top of that in the same way that a deck builder might and so on to kind of give strategic depth to the choices you might make about the build you accrue in the course of your kind of unpredictable adventures and the events that you go through. So it has a bunch of extra mechanics on top of normal pachinko and normal peggle in order to make that work. But fundamentally, that's what it is. It's a combination of two incredibly compulsive things. And the soundtrack slaps, which is the other thing about it. And I've played it with a kind of direct intensity to the point where I think I have now burned myself out on it and I'm out the other side. But I'm kind of, I'd be interested to know, because Jamie, you've been playing it as well, right?
I have been playing it. This game eats time in quite an extraordinary degree. I remember I played this a couple of years ago when it was first demoed or in early access, and I found it a little bit inscrutable. I found it a little bit tricky to kind of grok exactly how things are connected, but I think they've massively corrected that over the early access period, because this version of it is just so extremely compulsive. I mean, I do have a screenshot somewhere, which I think is a glitch, where according to Steam I've played something like 4,000 hours of Peggle Knights, which I think might have just been because I left it on for an entire year or something. One of my co-workers said, it's not even the best Peggle game, which I think is true. But yeah,
it's the sexiest, though.
Absolutely, it's the sexiest. It's Peggle, but with tits. Peglin, I think, is kind of, it's really good. It's really compulsive. It's, you know, because you have this kind of layer between what you're kind of doing. You know, in the Slay the Spire, you draw your cards and you have your actions. The fact that there is a kind of barrier between what your card, which in this game is your ball, what your cards do based on essentially skill, although it's Peggle, so it's not that much skill, is kind of really, really lovely and really, really wonderful, actually. And I can understand how some people might find it a bit rando, a bit less precise than your card-based, run-based type games. But for me, because I'm an idiot, and because I appreciate a game saying, oh, you did quite well there. Now have another go. Have another little shot at that little Peggle ball there. I find it, like, weirdly forgiving. Even when I've lost, I've still played some Peggle. So I'm happy.
Yeah, there is. It is more fun to watch a ball go badoink-a-doink down a bunch of pegs than it is to watch a card go slap. I would submit that as a kind of core emotional truth. But I do think its randomness is kind of a hindrance past a certain point. Like, I think I've beaten it as in done a full run and, like, gained the next prestige difficulty level 4 times, I think, with the basic Peglin, and unlocked all of the other Peglins you can get for getting other kind of conditions met in the course of it. So I haven't seen a ton. And I think it's interesting because with these games, including Slay the Spire, like, I've never been someone who gets super addicted and plays thousands of hours of them, because I hit a wall where I hit the wall of my own stupidness, basically. I get to the point where I can't manipulate the randomness in my favor anymore, even though I know that a more skilled player of the game, a more skilled deck builder would be able to. I hit the point where I'm not having fun because I'm just encountering the kind of core randomness. I hit this with Balatro, actually, was the most recent game I felt like I'd hit this with. But I have fun up to that point, and then I hit a wall, and then I tend to stop. And I think that's happened with Peglin. In Peglin's case, though, I think I'm right. I think it is a little bit too random at a certain point. But the thing that I think you're right about this, Jamie, the thing that takes the edge off that is the fact that in the moment to moment, it's also kind of more fun in some ways because of, like, the ways in which you can just screw yourself. Like, there are ways to get, you know, you can end up in a condition where I kind of misunderstood how a mechanic worked, and I ended up with balls that did no damage. The short version of its mechanic is every time a balls have, like, a damage value associated with them, every time they hit a peg, they'll add to your damage total at least that amount. And then there might be critical hit pegs that do more things, or bomb pegs that don't do damage in and of themselves, but would do a set amount of damage to every enemy, and all of these different things. I managed to get it set so that every peg was incredibly durable, like it would take several hits to break and therefore let the ball progress, while also none of my pegs did any damage. So what this meant was I had sort of broken Pachinko. I could release a ball into the system and it would just sort of bounce around, generate no damage, get stuck somewhere, despawn, and then do no damage, and then I would fire the next ball. And there was no recourse at this point. I just picked one artifact wrong, which is, like, the kind of the permanent modifiers to your deck. It was gone. I'd broken it. There was another good one recently where there's a boss in the second stage, which is quite tough, and the boss is, like, a ghost that's also a painter, and it flies across the screen, and it either does one or two things. It either, like, hits you with paint, or it replaces these 3 paintings that it puts up on the walls of its little stage. And the paintings, if they're alive, take the power out of the pegboard. And so you kind of want to destroy them. But if you destroy the paintings, you get given a stack of, like, an infection debuff that does damage to you every turn. I built a deck that I thought was pretty good overall, as long as I didn't hit this boss. And I had built it in the first half, in the first stage. And my deck was, every time I take damage, every opponent takes 7 times that amount of damage. And I have a whole bunch of other things that cause certain kinds of infection to stack and so on. So I take, like, escalating amounts of self-given damage, but I'm nuking everything else faster. I had no way to control what boss would appear on the second stage, but it was that boss. I got into that boss, and the first time I accidentally destroyed a painting, I ended up in a recursive death cycle where the damage I was taking from killing the paintings was doing damage to the paintings, which was adding the stacking damage to me. And I annihilated myself incredibly quickly. And because there's no way to, like, remove that stuff from your deck once you've committed to it, I was just boned. And there's so many variants of this. I don't want to lead with this, to be honest, too much as kind of the game's weakness. It's where I'm with it now after 10, 12 hours with it. Because I think genuinely it's a lot of fun getting to that point. But beyond all of that, beyond the kind of deck building, kind of impreciseness of the kind of capacity to screw yourself, There's also the fact that sometimes ball just bounce wrong way. And you're like, fuck, why did it bounce that way? Now I've died. And when the stages take like half an hour to beat sometimes, that can be a kind of a strange negotiation with the value of one's time. But I like the goblin a lot. And I like it when the ball bounce right way. And that dichotomy has kept me compelled for a really long time.
I mean, there's something interesting about it, right? Which is it is a game of, you're playing Peggle and Slay the Spire, mm-hmm. At the game's kind of opening. And where you want to get yourself by the end is basically to a point where you're just playing Slay the Spire, because you want to be able to fire off a ball and for it to not really matter where you hit it, because whatever you've done to your deck, whatever modifiers you have to the board and stuff like that will just proc off anything pretty much no matter what you do. And so you don't have to think about that, which is interesting, right? Because it's like a game trying to get you to stop playing the game. I had one run where it was my first winning run actually, where I'd only really taken upgrades that are to do with bombs. And the bombs are really fun in Peglin, right? Because when they pop off, they they shoot you flying off across the board, which is always a good feeling. And I just had it so that like pretty much everything I did spawned more bombs, or made the bombs deal more damage, or made the bombs kind of reload and stuff like that. So when I got to the final boss, I fired one ball, and it just bounced around and killed the boss in one hit. And it was an enormously satisfying feeling. But I put no skill into that shot because I didn't need to. It was just it could go anywhere and it probably would have won. And that is satisfying, but it is also, you know, slightly contradictory about the nature of the game. You know, you past a certain point, Peggle skill becomes more and more irrelevant.
Yeah, I think it's kind of fun in a way that, like, it is fun to break the machine in your favor, right? Like, I mean, but I think they kind of know this, like, it's very powerful to have multi-ball. Like, having some way to fire multiple balls is just good, like, most of the time. And a lot of the kind of like permanent modifiers have like an upside and a downside. And there's one that limits you to suddenly only aiming in like one of four directions. Like it becomes much more digital, like what you can choose. But you fire a ball in the opposite direction of the one that you're forced to aim in. And I found that with most of my really successful builds, you always take that if it's available, because you're right. Like at a certain point, the aiming's less important than just maximizing coverage of whatever combo you've set up. Like a lot of my really effective ones have been about having things that upgrade the pegs, so add sort of standing points to them when you hit them, and then making the pegs more durable, and just getting into this thing where the balls just sort of sit in the machine for ages, kind of rattling around and setting themselves off and generating these massive numbers when they kind of filter towards the bottom. But it is full, I will say, as a game of its type, it is full of like interesting, I think it's really interesting because it is full of like interesting ideas and twists on it, like stages with black holes in them, or things that affect kind of where the ball wants to go and so on, and the way the enemies work, and like when, where you can and can't target certain enemies, and where you're kind of encouraged to prioritize certain kinds of damage and so on. Like there's a lot of thought going into it. I think it's interesting that I think it has an uneasy relationship with that underlying chaos of like what ball do, but that same chaos is what kind of has made it kind of fun and compelling. And I think also the tone of it from like a art style point of view, from a kind of like you're just a little goblin point of view, all works really nicely together as well. Like it wouldn't work as well with like Slay the Spire's world building attached to it. Like it works because, you know, because it feels like it's sort of intentionally scrappy and kind of a little, you know, small and quite cute in a way.
I think if it was less frivolous, it would be extremely annoying.
Right.
Yes, it's funny because there was another game which has the same premise, roguelike Peggle. That was called Round Guard. That was from a couple of years ago, and that was less frivolous and more kind of high production value, but also less fun. Like it was, the loop of it was slower. It was less satisfying, you know. It was almost like, yeah, it just didn't have as much depth as Peglin, which you know, Peglin isn't necessarily the deepest game ever. And there's another one coming as well, I saw on someone's Twitter page. So there's like a few of these kind of bouncing around, looking for holes to drop into.
Both of those other games, are they also connected to like a Slay the Spire style roguelike run, or are they more pure Peggle games? Oh, okay, right.
No, they're proper like, Slay the Spire run-based. I mean, you know, if you were being cynical, you could say, well, you're not being cynical. If you were being truthful, you know, there's obviously quite a verve, and has been over the last 5 or 6 years or so, of something plus run-based roguelike, you know, but there's also been some completely remarkable games that have come out of there. It's not like there's a huge amount of sludge out there, or if there is, it's not coming to me. But like, yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, there is another interesting game to be made on this model. You know, I think this doesn't do everything possible. I think there's more room to go, potentially.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised that, maybe I'm just ignorant of them, but that there haven't been more Peggles, to be honest. Like, you know, just because it's a fun format. Like, I was instantly sold on this because, you know, I had basically just finished kind of rinsing Tactical Breach Wizards, and I kind of wanted something to fill the same space of like, I have half an hour, I will load this and play a run at something or tinker away at a mission in Breach Wizards case. And I was instantly sold. You really didn't need to tell me more than like deck build Peggle. You know, it's very rare that there's something that immediate, you know, like.
And I think the game kind of communicates it kind of well as well. Something about the art, something about the way it kind of, the way it's sort of the flow of it when you start it up, it kind of tells you that like this game is kind of slight. There are depths there possibly for people who want to really get into it. But like there's something about the theming of it that makes you feel like, oh, this is just, you know, like Peggle, right? It's a casual game. And this has a kind of casual roguelike vibe to it, which I think when it's working is really good. But yeah, you know, yeah, potentially when you're sort of pushing at it, it's less satisfying.
As you know, as a casual game, whatever it means, because as you say, like it is possible to spend 4,000 hours playing Peggle quite happily. I think there is something to be said for the fact that I will say this: the flip side to the "oh, it's random" thing is randomness is a great equalizer and a great cover for one's own like failings, right? Yeah. Like it's a gentler way of like, you know, when I hit that wall with something like a Bellatro or something like a Slay the Spire, I kind of know it's me. I'm the problem. Like, you know, like I'm not getting it, or there's something I could learn. And the evidence of this is the scores my friends are putting up, or the things I'm seeing other people achieve. Whereas in something like this, it's like, it's almost magnanimous of it to be like, ah, I'm just going to fucking break. And you wouldn't have to, you wouldn't have to ask any questions. Like, you know, that's, I appreciate that about it, I think, in the end. And I think that's like, that's in maybe an underexplored niche of like how much sort of deck builder or roguelike grit can you bring into a casual game and have it kind of remain casual and remain sort of breezy, but with the additional fun of like, I've built a mad engine that rattles and breaks and does fun things when it explodes. I also did a bomb build, Jamie, on my first like successful run, but I also upgraded all bombs to be the red bomb that also hurts you. There's a recurrent theme here where I became a victim of my own success, where it's like, that's an 80 bomb, oh shit.
Just imagining I you playing appreciate- real pachinko and accidentally throwing yourself into the machine and being crushed under a mound of small metal balls.
Have you guys ever watched The Wall, the pachinko-based Danny Dyer presented BBC quiz game called The Wall? I can really recommend it. I mean, there's a couple of episodes on YouTube. It's quite hard to find much more than that. But The Wall, it's a pachinko-based game. Danny Dyer delivers his classic catchphrase, "Is it right? Or is it wrong?" Which is literally his catchphrase when he's asked a question in that show. And it has Angela Rippon doing the kind of question asks. Like, Danny doesn't have to do any of the actual question asking. He just has to stand there looking faintly hungover in a suit. They drop balls down. You have to kind of bet on. It's really good. Like, it's a really good game show that they should make more of. yeah, just look up the wall. It's a great time. I also appreciate in Peglin the commitment to stupid ball puns for pretty much everything you do. So you have a viscorbate, exascorbate, extraordinary. Like, I like the way that there's puns that don't really work. Like,
there's a lot one of called puns on the words.
Oh my gorb. That should be funny, but it is.
There's a lot of puns on the word spin, even though nothing in the game visibly spins. Like, implicitly you understand the balls are probably spinning, but they're not animated doing so. So, actually, no, they are. I'm wrong. That's most clearly true with the little squirrel ball, I realize now. So I'll take that one back. There's a bit, I think a lot of the achievements have like a weariness about their puns that you can tell they were like, we're done. Like, in a ultimately very charming way. But yes, it's good.
It's only a tenner as well. It felt like
I've got my many hours worth, I think. And I've kind of made myself want to play it, even though I keep swearing that I'm done with it and I can move to more kind of, you know, high calorie things. It's nice to be the little goblin. Do you know who else it's really nice to be?
No.
Lieutenant Titus of the Ultramarines. Or either of his best friends.
I think a Warhammer Peggle game could work quite well, actually. Like, you're sort of firing balls through the infinite space, trying to avoid the warp. I mean, I don't know much about Warhammer, but I'm assuming there's something
you
can do that.
In the grim darkness of the far future, there is only ball. That's...
Ball never changes.
Orb, surely. Orb is better.
Orb. Yeah. No, you're right. It is. You're right. We can workshop this. We can make it work. Orb never changes.
Yes.
That's good. But that is Fallout. So I'm not sure if we're allowed that in there. So we can cross those particular streams. I almost got a complete tangent then. I always forget how inspired by Warhammer the first Fallout games were. I think that's always one of those like low-key inheritance people forget about. Like, yeah, like Brotherhood of Steel, like straight up Space Marines, like the kind of the tech worship, the kind of like, we've forgotten how to make this, but now we sort of worship it and we've reclaimed knightly language and imagery to kind of like, and surrounded our like kind of our big men with that. Like, it's interesting. Like, I think as, this is not the tangent I was expecting to go on, but just like Fallout 1 is like an artifact of like early 90s video game world building, which is sort of kind of original in its combination of the things it's inspired by, and it wears those influences really openly. It's really easy to call out like any post-apocalyptic fiction, like Mad Max and something with Fallout, but I think Warhammer is actually underappreciated as a kind of quite distinct influence on it. Which brings us back to the war we've been fighting. And I've been looking forward to talking about this because I was playing it when we recorded the last podcast. But yeah, how do we want to crack open Warhammer Space Marine 2?
Yes, that's a good question. It's sort of Schrodinger's woke. Currently, as it is being both blamed and embraced as woke, and it is unclear to me which of those things, if any, it is, since it's the CEO of Saber Interactive seemed to go on a rant online. He hasn't owned up to this being him, but also the company has not denied it being him, which I would assume they would do if it wasn't him, saying how good it is that we can now make games without any politics in. And here is our game with unproblematic supermen stomping on other races that challenge the authority of a totalitarian regime. Completely unproblematic, also completely without politics. And yet it seems to have been dunked on Steam for being too woke. So, it is in a strange place in these times of unending, meaningless culture wars.
I think it is more fair to say that it has been a weird representative, as you say, kind of deeply familiar in some ways year of one game after another inheriting the burden of this culture war that doesn't seem to be quite gaining traction in the way that it might have done a decade ago. Space Marine 2 is only the latest in a line of games this year. Go back to Helldivers right at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
Yep. That had exactly this debate. Helldivers, for almost exactly the same reason, right? Helldivers inheriting a bunch of its sort of Verhoeven-ish kind of Starship Troopers DNA, also from the same milieu that produces Warhammer in the 80s, right? It's all coming from the same source of I think sort of 2000 AD-ish, sort of slightly punk, slightly winking, slightly kind of indulgent, grotesque kind of science fiction of various kinds that now act as a bit of a kind of optical illusion to whatever kind of political lens people are trying to throw at it. Because my top note on the game, the thing that I would say experientially that I loved about it is I played through the whole campaign in co-op with friend of pod, Paul Kahneman. We had an amazing time, and it was the most fun I have had with a shooter campaign for a long time, actually, on the basis of something I'd like to get into, which is what it takes for a shooter campaign of 8 to 10 hours to feel really full and satisfying and for it to escalate in really satisfying ways. But also, since the days of Halo and Gears of War couch co-op with my friends, which was a really that's a core kind of very positive gaming memory for me. And it really does transport me back to 2010 or, 2009 and 2008, those years of those games, being back up from uni and playing those games with my friend. And that I am capable of being transported back to that period in my life without also inheriting a whole bunch of political package alongside that or the other things people might want it to be. I would argue those are actually distinct experiences, that it can be throwback as a gaming experience and that have nothing to do with the political payload of its world building, basically, yeah, at all. I think it's a common trick among grifters to say that reclaiming a quality that you might miss from games of a few years ago also necessitates regressive politics of kind X or Y.
Yeah, because, they're trying to pitch these two things against each other as though it's zero sum. For every woman you add to the game, there's one less piece of cover that you can crouch behind or something. It doesn't work like that. That's not how games get built. But actually, I think even though it is, in some ways it does kind of conjure those couch co-op specters back into life, I think there is quite a lot to it, which is quite fresh and original about the way that deals, about the way that combat is designed in the game. I think there's a little bit of Bloodborne in there where you're committing yourself to acts of dangerous melee action and vulnerability in exchange for building back armor and you sort of do parries in order to gain execution moves or deliver devastating gunshots to enemies. And what's interesting about it is that it takes the kind of that risk reward that you get in Bloodborne, but actually instead of it just being one kind of vector of reward as a result of that, it actually allows you to kind of apply the power that you gain from taking that risk in a lot of different ways. So you can do it to do single execution moves. You can do it to deliver a lot of damage against a single, more powerful enemy. And it helps you power up it helps you replenish your armor, and it also allows you to kind of do larger special moves. I forget what they're called, the special abilities that the Space Marines have, which have all kinds of different effects depending on which character you're playing. And so it's actually this thing which has quite a lot of in the execution of it, it feels quite kind of blurry, I'd say. It's not a very precise game in the same way that Bloodborne is. And some of that stuff feels quite mushy. It's not quite clear when you're going to be parrying stuff or which attacks actually even get flagged as parryable. But the actual kind of tactical richness that it then rewards you with is quite impressive, and I've not seen something exactly like that, even though it feels a little kind of mushy and imprecise.
I think it's way more novel than I think it appears like it's going to be. Or I think it's the fact that you could probably play the entire campaign in single player on like normal or easy and not encounter the depth it actually has, or experience its interesting ideas as almost like bugs. Like, I think it doesn't necessarily make the rest showing of itself. And I've seen that in some of the reactions that I've heard of it, but I think the core tour is having a good time. Part of the core tour is having a really good time with it playing on a harder setting. I think that is one of those, it's, and I would submit that when games do have interesting systems under the hood, it's one of the kind of bits of evidence for that can be, does it get more interesting if you turn the difficulty up?
Yeah.
Like, rather than just getting, and I think one of the things that's the interesting little kind of bait and switches that it's doing is it has the aesthetic and to some extent the kind of structure of a modern sort of action or shooter campaign. And I think over the last, you know, since the Halo games and to an extent the Gears of War games as well, like largely those have gravitated towards more and more of like a sort of Simon Says sort of combat design where you're told what to do and you do that thing, right? And there's lots of different manifestations of this in slightly different genres. Like shooters approach it differently. In the case of it's, because it's a third person game, because it's got this, a quite prominent melee system. The other thing is inheriting some of the cues from like an Arkham game, right? Like from the Rocksteady Batman games, which are strict Simon Says games, right?
Yes,
they are about matching exactly the inputs to the kind of threat that's coming your way. Space Marine doesn't advertise the fact that it's actually a lot more analog than that, that it does have call outs for like dodge this or parry this, but they're not prescriptive and they're not the only things that those mechanics apply to. They're sort of like invitations to use the mechanics for a specific outcome, but you could also use the same systems to get your own kind of to
it should be, in victory. Fact, otherwise you'll take damage in a lot of situations where you could easily parry it.
If you're not parrying things, you should be parrying. And in that regard, I think it's kind of interesting. Like, I've not seen games sort of look didactic while secretly being quite analog. Like, that doesn't sort of happen.
Do you feel that's a flaw or not? I feel like it could be a flaw.
I respect I've heard and I've chatted to people who hated it because of that. Because that was, you know, just confusing and unsatisfying, and because it's hard, because it's quite punishing. And because you can die quickly. I think for me, like, the moments where I think we had that question last week about games that make you sit up, and I think I mentioned Space Marine. The moments where I found Paul and I, like, sitting up was when we realized that if we talked to each other and planned and had a strategy, we would do better, which isn't a given in, like, a AAA action game, right? That, like, and the best evidence for that I can give you is, like, throughout the campaign, there were scenarios that we failed horribly, got kicked back to like a loading screen and then reapproached with a plan and aced the first time, like almost like without changing the difficulty setting, just went from like, we can't do this to now that we have an idea of how to do it, we're going to pick our gear accordingly. And we're going to position ourselves accordingly and make decisions and pick roles for ourselves. And that's really satisfying. And like, actually Halo on hard difficulties is one of the only like co-op shooter campaigns, I think, that has also had that feeling for me where it's like, we will get pasted if we just run at this. But as soon as you start to engage with the tactical space of it, the game actually opens up a lot rather than just being like, oh, you didn't do the thing I was expecting you to do, therefore punishment.
Yeah. I think as a kind of corollary to saying that you need to burden on a hard setting, you also need to play it with another human being. Because if you just ramp up the difficulty in single player, it becomes punishing in a way which is quite unedifying, because you need to divide responsibility between the kinds of threats you face, and your AI just won't do that. So you'll end up you'll just die because you get an awful lot of chip damage from enemies that are at a range. And that can happen quite quickly. And it's just like, oh, okay. Nothing I could have really done there. I'm looking at a loading screen again.
Yeah.
But if you turn down the difficulty in single player, then it becomes kind of trivial, just button mashing, basically. No thoughts required, which is fine, but it's also the game has more potential in it to be wrung out of it, I think. And you only see that if you're playing with another person.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to kind of fully market games as co-op, but it feels like, you know, I kind of bought it on the expectation that I'd be playing it in co-op. I've exclusively played it in co-op, because it also has a co-op campaign as well. And like, I think it's, that's where its quality really shows. And I would also say that I think I managed to set myself up for a really optimal experience, because I think genuinely, like, I don't know if we'll necessarily do like an end of year pod for like games of the year, but playing through that campaign in co-op with one person all the way through is like one, not in a single sitting, like we sort of did a few mornings of the week while I was off work. It's genuinely one of the most fun I've had with a game this year. And the reason for that is twofold. One is, I think it's a really good co-op campaign. We could talk about like set pieces and so on. The other is, it is such a love letter to 40K specifically. Like, it really is. It's, you know, it kind of goes without saying, it's like the most spectacular that setting has ever looked. And I think, as someone who obviously loves tabletop Warhammer, everyone, like, there is a desire to see the models come to life and to see those worlds come to life. That's not just expressed through the books, but through all the kind of the other kind of supporting material, particularly like, you know, to see like the kind of the small tabletop miniatures and that very specific mind's eye experience rendered at scale is like the purpose of like the really spectacular art that gets produced as well, right? Like the kind of, to create that sense of, I think that's one thing that's always drawn me to Warhammer, is that sense of spectacle and scale. And like, you tell like 14-year-old me, and there were 10,000 aliens, then yeah. I'm like, I can imagine that. And then, and I will, like, that's, that'll be the response I have. And so this game's kind of ability to render the swarms at scale and so on is really genuinely spectacular. But also, it is, I think, like, across the course of the campaign, I don't want to spoil it. Like, so it is, on one hand, it is, you know, a fairly, like, kind of archetypical Warhammer 40K Space Marine story with sort of archetypal characters and situations to some extent. It's also intensely nerdy about the setting, in details and in sort of specific moments, in ways that are quite gratifying. But they're gratifying particularly if you're playing them in co-op and you can point out those details to someone else who also cares, like, about that sort of thing. Like, that kind of a game of like, oh, have you seen this? Like, at Warhammer World in Nottingham, there are a series of like incredible dioramas, like physical dioramas that they've built. You can go around them in a gallery setting. And part of the joy of that is, not, you can see them by yourself, but part of the joy of them is going around them with another human being who also loves that world and pointing at things and going, look at this. And look at that, there's a little assassin in there or whatever, right? Like, and that's the joy of it. And the Space Marine achieves the same thing. Like, look at that. Like, and when characters make offhand references to some deep part of the Horus Heresy or something like that, and you're like, oh, I'll explain that to my friend now and feel good about myself. and then the other thing it does, and I don't want to go too deep on this point because I think it's could be classified as a spoiler, even though I've seen people post it all over the internet. There are moments in it where it leans in to some extent, it leans into the kind of history of like memes and fan lore around 40K, which is a kind of, it can speak that language a little bit of like the kind of the playful side of things. But also there is a moment towards the very end, which is a reference to something, to like, it's basically a reference to the style of 40K itself and to a very iconic piece of 40K art. So it's kind of meta in that sense. But there's a moment where they do the thing in a way that I know it's really frustrating for me to not want to spoil it for people who haven't encountered it, but I was genuinely like, as soon as I realized it was happening, and there's like, I mean, I won't spoil the exact scenario, but it's basically hold X to recreate the classic piece of 40K art. And I loved that little willingness to wink at like, we know what this is. You know, we know kind of where this comes from. We know where people love it. And that, I think, I found that like, me and Paul were fucking whooping like for joy at like the fact that they did the thing. And in a world of like quite cynical IP kind of material, I think, and sort of khaki jangling kind of cameos and stuff like that, that was a rare moment of like, oh, you got me, you really got me with this. Because what I needed was a reference to a piece of art from 1993. But it really did, it really got me. And actually, in that case, 1987, that piece of art was old design. And kind of both. And I think, like, to actually almost to return to that first thing you raised, Marsh, about the kind of like, is the game woke or not? I think one of the things that's probably quite interesting about it is like, it's because it is such a successful celebration of 40K, at least to me, I think it kind of like highlights that there are qualities in that setting, and there's qualities in the capacity you might have to really enjoy the time you spend with that setting that are not linked to one particular side of a,
right.
a piece of identity politics, but are actually simply the qualities of a piece of pop culture that can be celebrated for what they are rather than hoisted up in that particular way in yes. the pursuit of a retweet.
Yeah, I think it's highly unlikely that there are many, many pieces of pop culture that are in fact either pure wokeness or chud bait. So it's, and you know, I think the fact that it is considered to be both simultaneously is perhaps a sign that the entire argument is dog shit and should be ignored.
Yeah. Could it be even, I think we were on the edge of saying it, but like, I think it is fair to say that the moment someone uses a phrase like woke detector to apply to a game, they've already lost, I think, any rational, critical argument, basically by invoking a complete, sort of a completely fabricated and sort of the deeply tired lens. I will say, I think like it's a much bigger subject than I think we could probably try and articulate in this venue. But obviously, we're talking about video games. Like, of course, we're going to collide with the fact that like we depict violence for fun and we depict kind of fantastical scenarios for fun, and we kind of toy with big dangerous concepts and things. And it's also completely willing, I think it's completely valid to look for diversity of form, right? And I think there's lots to celebrate in terms of the breadth of experiences that are now available. And it is not a zero-sum game. Slice people's pie does not get smaller because the overall slate of things shrinks. Right.
Right.
Like the part of me that loved playing Halo games and Gears of War games with my friends is the same part of me that loved playing Warhammer with my friends growing up. It's the part of me that stopped gaining new ideas at the age of 14. But I am capable of liking and appreciating broader things than that. And it doesn't take away from my ability to appreciate that. I also appreciate that given who I am, I'm squarely in the kind of the crosshairs of this kind of media, and I want and celebrate people creating things for people who are not me and don't have my particular kind of, you know, cultural middle-class white boy with a PC and a little bit of pocket money for pots of goblin green paint to, you know, to feel included in entertainment and culture. The fact that it's not zero sum, I think, is the thing that completely dismantles the whole purpose of any of these arguments, because the fact is multiple things are possible. Like, and the fact that Space Marine's existence is not the existence of this video game can be celebrated as like, I do miss campaigns like this. Actually, I do. Right. Like, I do miss big budget, spectacular, sort of generous feeling shooter campaigns. It feels like it's been a while. It also feels like it's been a while to get a game like that with such robust support for co-op, for example. You know, those are all things worth celebrating. They are not salvos in a kind of historical revision, like sort of recidivism. They're not going to pull us back in time to 2011. And to be honest, I became a games journalist in 2011. I'll tell you what people were arguing about then. It's the same fucking thing. So like, yeah,
is there something in Warhammer called Primarch? Because I was watching some footage of it earlier, and I was made myself laugh imagining some space marines wandering around the underwear section trying to find some bargains.
The Primarchs. So this is a trap card that you've laid in front of me. Like, so if you don't want me to answer the question, tell me now.
I would like nothing more than for you to tell me what Primarchs are.
Okay, Primarchs, but not with a K, with a CH, like Archon rather than like Ark of the Covenant. Primarchs.
You just used another made up word to explain one made up word.
That's Greek.
Oh, okay. with your space talk.
Sorry, I think that's the most middle class thing I could have bellowed.
Sorry, darling. It's Greek, darling.
out yourself as a middle-class white British teenager who loved Warhammer without outing yourself. So scream, that's Greek, actually. Much like Gulfarius and Omegon, Primarchs of the 20th Legion, the Alpha Legion. So the Primarchs are the 21, technically, children of the Emperor of Mankind. They were his genetically modified super boys. They were created to be a bulwark against, or a kind of a bulwark against chaos, and the means by which the Imperium would achieve its kind of reclamation of the stars. The Primarchs were sabotaged by chaos, sent adrift in the warp until they were subsequently rediscovered by the Emperor, and then each put in charge of legions of space marines derived from their own gene seed or DNA. So every space marine legion of the original 20 legions can trace its kind of genetic lineage to its Primarch, which is why they talk about them so much. Of those 21, technically, two are a complete mystery. They've never been known about. Half of them turned to chaos during the Horus Heresy, just about became bad. The rest of them are mostly dead, except Rabuta Gilliman, the Primarch of the Ultramarines, the Space Marine chapter featured in Space Marine 2, who is back and around, and that's why they refer to him and his plans. His kind of intent for the various worlds of the setting. Does that answer your question, Jamie? It's dad. Primarch is dad.
Yeah.
What's the lineage of the pound stretchers?
they call them imperial fists, actually.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad I now know what Primarchs
are. Yeah, the great Aldi ones. that was my big answer on what a Primarch is. If for more like this, just dial back the clock a few years and listen to lots of Minis Monthly, where I think at one point Tom and I had a whole bit about, I think we have a playlist for like, there's like a different song per Primarch. We got quite into it. Several references to them in this game. It's great. There's so many big Warhammer things that happen. I think it is the hardest a game has ever Warhammered. And I did say that as someone who loves the setting, obviously, and now contributes to it occasionally, which I can't really lay. It's obviously the elephant in the room for all of the things I've said. It's nice to see it get sort of taken up so much by, in the more positive sense, beyond the kind of causes it's been recruited into, to kind of see it kind of taken up by people and people get kind of joy out of it has been great. And I will say, I will not get tired of any, I think there's a genre now. I think Halo is part of this genre. I'm talking about those campaigns, and I realized something kind of integral to their storytelling, which is a level of seriousness that allows your characters to say to each other, like, we face dire odds. It's time to do the sickest shit you've ever seen. Like we will make no small plans today, brother. We're going to do something cool. And that's the tone I want my action campaigns to have. You know, I never want it to be like, let's do something discreet now. Let's solve this problem efficiently. No, brother.
I'm very excited, actually, about the Mechanicus 2, which is coming out at some point. Because that first game, like, I was a bit of a nervous boy with the tactics in it and couldn't quite get my head around it. It's quite a complex game on that level. But the theming of it, the grumbling of it when anyone talks and just goes, which is really great. And then this like beautiful music that they had for that one, which has like a kind of amazing, like cyber techno Gregorian chant crossover vibe, which is just completely spectacular. That kind of, as a sort of Warhammer novice, that was one of my favorite kind of introductions to that kind of world, because the tech priests guy, whatever they're called, are really good fun to kind of play as and watch.
I have, and I'm not joking, there is someone made, like, I think it may be official, like a 1 hour video of the Mechanicus soundtrack on YouTube. I have written 3 novels to that soundtrack. only intercut with Jasper Kidd's Darktide soundtrack, which I think is a 2 hour soundtrack. and just those two on loop. Literally, like, to the point that in my regular writing schedule, one lap of the Mechanicus soundtrack is like a good writing session. And it is that, yeah. And I'm not even writing 40K. Like that I think is like, but I think it's kind of, a rare example of like someone just getting it perfectly. Like, I love that soundtrack. I've listened to it far more than I played the game, actually, at this point. So I should really play more.
I think they say on their Twitter page that they make games for him to soundtrack. That's how they describe themselves, which is quite sweet. Shall we talk about UFO 50?
Yes! Yes. A different kind of space horror.
Yeah.
UFO 50 is... Oh, sure. You go for it. You explain what it is.
You? Me explain?
Yeah.
Okay. So UFO 50 is the new game from Mossmouth, which is Derek Yu. He of Spelunky and Spelunky 2. And... so obviously a bit of a genius and a bit of a hero of mine. This is his thing that he's been working on for sort of 7 or 8 years now. It's called UFO 50. It's him and a bunch of other designers creating 50 individual games, which are ostensibly based on the kind of back catalogue of a arcade company called UFO. And this is a kind of, it's sort of presented to you as a sort of almost like a ROM collection. And you have a big old list of games to play through, which range from puzzle games to platformers to various golf games and beyond. They've kind of covered pretty much every genre across the collection. And you kind of, when you open it up, you kind of dive in, try a game, bounce off it, try another one. It's kind of a sort of a unique experience, really. I've never seen anything quite like this. It made me think a little bit of the Magnetic Fields album, you know, 69 Love Songs. It's sort of the scale of it and the ambition of it is very impressive. And I think one of the things I would really like about it is that kind of the right level of the uniformity of style that they kind of achieve across the collection. You know, the sort of the color palettes they use, the kind of theming they use, the fact that there are kind of the sort of almost like environmental storytelling between some of the games because they're sequels to some or like ones that build on the ideas of others. It's a kind of really interesting little package, which I wish I liked more than I did, more than I do. I feel bad about myself for not liking it as much as I do because, and I am going to push at it. I am going to work at it because I want Derek Yu to be impressed with me and to think I'm clever like he is. But I think... I find a lot of the games very inscrutable, quite hard in the way that classic arcade games definitely were. And I find that it almost feels a little bit contemptuous towards me in a funny kind of way. That's kind of the feeling I have when I play it. I feel like I'm not cool enough or good enough to play these awesome things. You know, if only I was, you know, more patient or more... kind of willing to sort of think things through. And I guess that's kind of where I've ended up at with it.
I'm glad you're saying this because I've been watching the kind of the responses come in from other game designers and they're all having like a religious experience with this game. Like, I've been blinded by the game design. The game design sun has revealed itself to me. My mind has been melted by the dark truths therein. And I'm just like, yeah, but it controls like absolute shit. You know? I'm trying to drive a car and it's only got 6 directions. It's awful. I find it very frustrating for that reason. I think there's obviously conspicuously a lot of very clever stuff going on there. I'd compare it to the beginner's guide in some ways in that it's sort of trying to tell an a biography of a games company or game creator through these sequence of games. And that it's doing some clever meta stuff there as well. And even in the games themselves, they're all novel spins on things that are familiar to people who've played games of that era. But the things that are also familiar to people who've played games of that era is that they are not great in some ways. Like, simply the control of, like, I don't want a character who in a platform who moves as sluggishly as the character in the very first game in this list does. I forget what it's called, but it's a sort of Metroidvania, extraordinarily punishing Metroidvania style game that it puts first as your first experience of the whole lot. And like, I'm just not patient enough to want to hurt myself for 20 to 30 minutes before the greater depth of any of these games either reveals itself or does not. And I find a lot of them quite like aggressive. Yeah, contemptuous is also a way I'd use to describe them. Amongst that, though, there are great games there that I've enjoyed, a couple of them anyway. There's and they're all the ones which have the easiest, smoothest onboarding. Like, there's the adage of easy to play, hard to master. I think that is controversially, I think that's good game design. I'm sorry, I don't like games that are hard to play and also hard to master. Like,
I like hard to play, easy to master. I think that's...
Yeah. Well, you said it's unknown to me because so many of the games are hard to play. Whether that is exactly the payoff, whether their depth tops out really early and it's just an incredibly difficult onboarding and then there's no depth at all, that could be what a lot of these games are like. But they're just simply so hard that I can't be bothered to put the time in to find out. The games that I have put more time into have all of them ended up blossoming in some unusual and unexpected way where there's it like a layer of the onion is suddenly peeled off. After like an hour or even 2 hours of play, and suddenly some whole new mechanic emerges. That's a very cool experience. And but I just don't know that that's true for all of them, and whether it's just wasted time. And I none of them explain themselves. None of them come with even like instructions or what buttons to press or anything. I just feel like that could be a bare minimum that you could do to make it slightly more palatable to people. I don't know why you wouldn't do that unless you were trying to be obscurist in a way which is off-putting.
Just to avoid people writing in, you can press start and then check the controls of any game you're playing and it'll give you a little list.
Yeah, but there's no none of the games begin with any kind of instruction as to what your objective is and so forth. I liked Max and Mini, or maybe it's Mini and Max. It's a game. It's a sort of Metroidvania, I guess, where you are in this very you're locked in a tiny room, but you can shrink down to be very small, and then it becomes a much bigger room, and then you can shrink down even further to a even greater micro level, and in this room, there's all kinds of, there's little bugs moving around the carpet and stuff like this. And it's just a platformer exploratory space. But then you encounter characters who ask you to collect things for them elsewhere and you go elsewhere. But at any point, you can kind of resize yourself. So you can, if you don't want to walk across to the other side of the level, you simply become big, walk two steps and then shrink yourself down again. It's nice. It's one of the only games that I find accessible, but it also has some very nice. It reminded me of Chip and Dale, needlessly, but it also has your ability to pick up things, like in Super Mario Brothers 2, where you could jump on the on enemies' heads and just lift them up above yours and then lob them around. There's a game, I forget what it's called, Pilot something, Pilot Idol. It's like a mixture of an idle clicker game with a sort of a Zelda-ish top-down exploration thing. You crash land on a planet and there's this big crystal and you need to poke the crystal in order to get little crystals out of it, and then they buy you things. And then the things that you buy allow you to harvest more crystals quicker in all in an effort to buy meat so that so you can explore the overworld. The more meat you have, for some reason, means the more minutes you have to explore the overworld. And then as you explore the
overworld... This is also true of life, for me. Yeah.
Then you find the things that you're looking for to repair your ship, ultimately, I guess. That seems quite novel. As a clicker game, though, again, there's a lot of intentional time wasting. And I find that quite aggravating, but maybe no more so than other clicker games. I don't know. What are the games that have not appalled and annoyed you?
Well, none of them have appalled me. And I am going to put some more hours into this game because, you know, like... Spelunky and Spelunky 2, like two of my favorite games of all time. And like those are games that like have obviously been broken wide open now at this point, years later. But one of the wonderful things about them was the way that they held their secrets, right? And you can tell that UFO 50 is sort of full of secrets. Whole like meta layer where there's like console commands you can enter. And I'm sure there's a bunch of interesting stuff in there. I wouldn't be surprised if there's hidden games or sort of alternative versions of it. Things like that will be really interesting to kind of poke at. And there are some games in there I really like. My favorite is called Kick Club, which is partially the reason I like it is because there was a game on the Amiga called Soccer Kid, which was a platformer where you're a little lad in a football kit and you had a ball and you could kick the ball at baddies, one of whom was Pavarotti, and
remember this really vividly.
It was a hell of a game, and this game is clearly influenced by that because obviously, you know, probably between them this team have played every single video game ever made. And it is that one was like a kind of scrolling platformer, as almost every game on the Amiga was, with giant sprites. This is a single screen, like single room clearer, and it's really like, it's really elegant. The ball is in the middle of the room. The baddies are all like evil sports stuff that isn't football. So in the first world, they're all like tennis and badminton people you're trying to defeat, which is quite funny. And what you need to do is kind of dodge the baddies, get to the ball, and then, yeah, kick the ball kind of around the room in order to beat the baddies, right? And you can bounce it off walls and you can bounce it off enemies. It just has to touch them. The ball just has to touch them with some kind of force in order to clear them. And then once they're all gone, you move on to the next level. It's just got an interesting level of strategy, right? Because like in real football, you're sort of thinking about where your ball is going to end up after you've kicked it, right? And you want to be able to get it back. And you can even do things like just like in real football. this is obviously the nerd's view of football, where it's just like, if I could just get the ball, then I could kick it.
If I could just get it to hit that tennis player with enough force to defeat them.
Maybe a
you
girl
need more
would
meat.
Kiss me.
That's what you need.
Yeah, I need more meat, yeah. But, you know, thinking about like that, and then you can also like head the ball. So you can sort of set up combos, basically. So you can kick the ball, it kills an enemy, bounce off a wall, and then you head it, and it kills another enemy. And for me, that's been the game I put the most hours into. You know, I've got to like World 2 or whatever, because it's so hard, of course. But it is, yeah, it's really elegantly designed and really kind of playable and fun. So I really like that one. There's another one called Velgress, which I'm describing as Up Downwell. the Downwell developer is a member of the team, so I don't know if it was his involvement, but it is exactly what it sounds like. And again, like Tomasz's point, that is the one which has the most easily grokkable controls scheme. You know, you're just jumping up through a kind of well. But it's really hard. It's a really, really hard game. Like, I wish they'd easy win a bit more. Give me a couple of levels that are easy. You know, Sonic the Hedgehog used to do that.
Yeah, I just appreciate a tiny bit of breathing space before they spank me mercilessly, I think.
Yeah, because, like, you know, we didn't really have the same culture of arcades in this country, right, that they did in America. And my memories of going to anything arcadey as a kid, although they did do this in The Simpsons, right, like where they played the Waterworld game, but like you put the money in the machine, you die in the game, and then you've got no money, and then you have to just go and look at other people playing the games, right? I never enjoyed that because I enjoyed playing video games. I didn't enjoy being laughed at by machines for being shit and having the reflexes of a child. And UFO 50 does kind of simulate that. It does kind of very like, ha ha, no, bigger kids playing now, you know. I sound like I'm being really mean to this game. I'm not. I kind of respect it. I respect its kind of commitment to the bit. It's just like, yeah, I think if you come from a kind of different place, it's a little bit less kind of convivial to you. Bushido Ball's good though. That's Pong with throwing knives. I quite enjoyed that. You select a character and then you play Pong, but in between hits you can throw shit at the other player, which is quite good fun. And there's all sorts of like interesting like gameplay things that they put in there. So for example, there's one power up which turns your enemy into a log if they trip on it, and you can do a thing where you kick the ball into it so that when they go to hit it, they turn into a log and you get sort of initiative back. That's kind of fun.
Have you played Cyber Owls, I think it's called?
I don't think I've played Cyber Owls, no.
I think it might be the 50th one, but it's a lot of these games, you can describe them and you think, oh, that sounds cool. And but I assure you playing them is less rewarding in some ways. Like this game, it sort of sets up you up with a sort of bad dude star premise. Are you bad enough to save the president sort of thing? And you pick from this team of owls, action owls, to go and do missions in different parts of the world. And so you select the first owl and it's this side-scrolling punch 'em up. And then I almost immediately got annihilated because it's incredibly, incredibly difficult. And you're like, oh, shit. So you select another owl. And this one's a completely different genre. This one's like a top-down early Metal Gear Solid style stealth 'em up, but with incredibly difficult and punishing and quite poorly articulated stealth mechanics. And then you die in that one. And then you realize, oh, I haven't actually died with either of these two characters. They're just captured and I can still select them. But now when I select them, I select a different owl to go and save them. And then you're playing the genre of the selected owl to save in the location of the captured owl. And it's a really exciting kind of way of juggling these genres. It's just that individually, they're all as basic as those genre expressions would have been in 1988, incredibly frustrating and difficult. But I know that there's something really clever going on there. I just feel like my hand is constantly being slapped and saying, you're not cool enough to play this, you're not cool enough to understand this.
To what extent do you think, because it's interesting, because like I haven't played it at all, so this is from the outside looking in, but a lot of those, I can't believe I'm going here, a lot of those same critiques, like this is simply inaccessibly difficult. There's a lot of genres that can track that, right? I'm going to go for the obvious one, like the From Software kind of thing, but it's one of the many areas where this can apply, right? The same could be true of like shmups, right? Like people who really love those games but don't play them. I understand what you're saying. Like, I think it makes sense to me, this feeling that in this particular case, there is something, there's a story being told here, or there's an experience being crafted that's probably very clever and sort of very kind of well kind of thought through and very well honed at a very high level, but it is simply inaccessible to me. That is a critique at basically word for word that I've heard leveled at Bloodborne, Elden Ring, etc. as well. Is the difference that the kind of landscape this is taking place within is like strictly nostalgic, and therefore it's not necessarily like as, I don't know, like even it doesn't even have like the basic line of analogies to kind of support someone giving it a go?
Yeah, I think the interaction between difficulty and nostalgia and the way that these games are inaccessible is interesting, because in Bloodborne, I mean, fundamentally in Bloodborne, you can move around in that game, no problem. It's a difficult game. It's a very difficult game. Enemies do a lot of damage. You can easily die. That's true. But fundamentally, like, there's no, it is as good as expressing one's movement within that world as the state of the art at the time it was released, Bloodborne. Whereas these games are being released today and have the state of the art in terms of like player movement and expression of 1988. And like, I understand that that's the era that they're specifically evoking, and it would feel anachronistic to provide players with more platforming affordances than the machines of that era were capable of. And yet, improvements have been made in the intervening years that are valuable, and I like them, and I wish they were in these games. You know? I don't need my characters to move like fucking pixel cows in order to have a believable retro experience. I think this is the problem with retro gaming. I think it's just like there are things that are persistently valuable from the games of those times. And I think there are characteristics that those games have that have since disappeared and are worth re-exploring again. But I personally don't have any kind of nostalgic attachment to the limits of those games. Such that I would be willing to endure them in excess today, I would say.
It's interesting.
Does that make
sense? It does make sense. I think, like, I do feel sort of duty bound to sort of defend this game again, because I'm worried that Derek, you will be disappointed with me probably and I'll get thrown out of Game Dev Club. But you know, the opening screen you get of this game is an image, like an old photo of Derek Yu opening an old storage locker, right? And like to basically reveal the UFO 50 catalog that was lost, right? And there's something I respect about it, which is what he's kind of saying with that, or what they are saying with this, is that this is just the way the games are, right? They're kind of saying that, like, in the way of retro games and the way of playing games from that era, they are just the way they are. And it's kind of, whether you like it or not, it's up to you to kind of approach these things on their own terms. And, you know, there is something to be said, I think, of the fact that, you know, games have got better for the most part. They have got more playable. There is ease of use. But without like wanting to sound like too much of a grognard, I guess there is a case to be made that like we've lost something interesting. There's things that have fallen by the wayside in the pursuit of an easy user experience flow that maybe is worth kind of re-examining. I mean, that's me kind of properly devil's advocating it. But there is something, you know, Spelunky is a game that, you know, roughly contemporaneous with Dark Souls, and similarly has that feeling when you first play it where you kind of, it's like, this is who I am, like, conquer me. You know, it's like, come at me, bro, kind of game, rather than sort of greasing the wheels for you. It's always been what Derek Yu's been about, and that is why I'm going to push at UFO 50 for a little bit longer, at least, just in case that it kind of, there's something about it that opens up.
Yeah, I mean, I know I sound really angry about the game, and I am, obviously, but I do. I mean, just because it's not accessible to me doesn't mean that it's not great. There's obviously a considerable genius being applied to it, and I too will carry on playing them. I haven't explored all 50 games yet, and I know that there is some meta game aspect to it which will emerge more fully over time, and I want to see that. And I do agree that it does insulate itself from a lot of the kind of criticisms you can level at it for being accessible by having that fictional layer saying this is the catalog of a particular games company. You know, it wouldn't need to say that, it wouldn't need to have the claim that its games are good or even likable for that fiction to be useful and persist. In the same way that, you know, like the Beginner's Guide, a lot of the games that you are exploring in that are half finished. You know, they aren't complete games, and that's fine because it's contextualized within a biography, essentially. And so you can do that here as well. But that doesn't make the moment-to-moment exploration of that pleasurable or even possible for me. but we'll see. There's so much more in it. Each of the games that I have played and explored to any great degree has opened up in such a way that it feels like there's several games within them. So this is like a, this is a huge work, I would say. There's a lot in it to explore.
Please go on, sorry.
So my frustrations at it are just like presumably very surface level, and there's a lot more to it.
I mean, the podcast Eggplant, previously the Spelunky show, like before they realized they were running out of stuff, they are doing a thing where for the next year they're going to play a game a week, which I think is a really good format. So I'm looking forward to like playing along with that at least a little bit, because I'll be playing each game each week and kind of getting into it. I'm gonna have a go at the one you mentioned, the pilot one. Maybe you could have a go at Kick Club and we can report that next week or next time we record.
Well, pilot one's an interesting one to do because it carries on playing itself in the background when you've got when you're playing other games, so you're still earning your idle clicker points.
It's kind of great.
Lost away. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to ask was if there's a sort of suspicion that it would be a very arch thing to do, but also a very clever thing to do, to sort of drop the whole game as a kind of mystery box, you know, for a community to pick apart and explain, you know, like if the absence of instruction and so on is sort of an intentional invitation. Like, I think that raises its own suite of issues, but like, it's an interesting, you know, it's that notion of like a game as like a collective object that people kind of drill away at from different angles, and that is too big and internally complex for any one person to kind of map personally is interesting. Like, is it satisfying for individuals? I don't think so. I don't think that was the experience of the man who got to the middle of the Curiosity Cube. But I do think
he got to be God.
He did.
In a video game. Except he didn't.
Yeah. But you see what I'm saying? Like, I think there's like, you know, it's sort of, it's interesting. Like, I do, like, I'm sort of tempted to agree, and I haven't played it, so I'm just agreeing from the sidelines that, like, to me, like, the issue with having sort of inaccessibility as an aesthetic quality is the difference between now and the late 80s, early 90s, whenever we're kind of taking inspiration from, is I don't have to bash my head against the only game that we have on the Amiga.
Yes.
Because I can play Peglin right now. And it's only the social contract established by the fact that we have webcams on that's stopping me playing Peglin right now. And so, you know, like there's, and I think that's a sort of, again, that's flawed logic, right? Like, the existence of easily consumable television does not preclude the existence of more challenging television or books or film or whatever, right? Many things can exist. But I do think there is something really tangibly unpleasant about the feeling of like, I just don't know how to interact with this. I don't know how to, you know, open this up to myself, right? Like, and maybe that's satisfying for some. I'm not sure it is for me. But yeah, incidentally, earlier I was thinking about, are there any games that are hard to learn and easy to master? And I think Quop is, in that if you've learned Quop, then actually it's fine.
Yeah. Should we do questions from questions?
So this question was from Quadratops via the Discord. He said, it seems to me what we commonly call games journos are closer to, quote, publishers of content for gaming enthusiasts than they are to traditional journalists. However, Bloomberg in the past few years has been treating this industry with a scrutiny hitherto mostly, although not totally, absent. It writes about it as if it were an extension of the tech industry worthy of serious analysis and not simply as toys for nerds, a stigma that in the past 10 years seems to have been greatly eroded. Do you see this differently? And, supposing you do agree, as former games journos and now game devs, what's your impression on this increased scrutiny and why do you think it's been absent for so long? Cheers.
Oh. Marsh and I think looking at each other there. I don't agree that this dichotomy is quite as pronounced as the question makes it out to be. I do agree that there's been quite a few really good examples of good investigative journalism and other forms of traditional journalism in the last couple of years. I think there are more platforms for that. I also agree that like enthusiast media, as it previously existed, was largely about entertaining people who enjoyed a particular kind of medium, right? Same as majority of film and music journalism as well, right? It's less about games journalism, more about entertainment media, right? As it has existed in one form or another for many, many years, like for decades. I think it has always been almost semantic to conflate the two. My argument would be that, and I'll come put this as an opening gambit, and then Martian, let me know if you agree. My argument would be that getting het up on the definition of the word journalist here is less useful than kind of highlighting that as games have matured as an industry and come to be taken more seriously as an industry, they have attracted more kind of like journalistic coverage, to use that phrasing. I also believe that previously, those of us working in like the entertainment media part of it have over many years in many different ways attempted to apply, you know, similar scrutiny and effort to journalistic endeavors while also making fart jokes and little captions. For that was the duality of the professional domain in which we found ourselves. I do think there's always been an uneasy relationship, but not to do with some kind of like self-limiting decision to just be like coverage of toys for nerds or something like that, but due to a kind of broader ecosystem around games media and entertainment journalism in general, which is not especially friendly to original or investigative work and never has been. The skill has always been deriving something of value from what is supported, basically, either from the perspective of the publishers of the media or the publishers of the games that you're covering. You're highly dependent on several different broader factors. And it's only through the arrival of like alternative kind of funding models or the interest of traditional outlets that it becomes possible to kind of invest the money necessary to make a big success of a different approach.
Yeah, I agree. They are toys for nerds still, though.
Yeah, they are.
But I think there's two other things there that that are markedly different. I mean, I agree with you that there isn't as stark a dichotomy as expressed in the question. But obviously, the industry itself has grown, and so it naturally attracts more scrutiny simply by being enormous and having a lot of money associated with it, which wasn't as true 15 to 20 years ago. It's bigger than film, music, and television combined. So obviously there is going to be more reporting around the economics and labor involved. But also I'd say conversely, something that was present 15 to 20 years ago but is now declined is criticism. I don't think criticism exists in the same form across any media as it did 15 to 20 years ago. Social media, if you like, the democratizing of expression itself has eroded the degree to which critics have been held in regard, rightly or wrongly. But I would say as a result of that, there is less interesting and deep thought in writing about games. There's more of it. I don't know that it's as much of it is as good.
That is an animating rage that causes all former Edge writers to rise from their coffins. Yeah, I think like it's interesting that because you can't sell criticism anymore, really. Like the kind of, yeah. I mean, you can, magazines still exist, but like the decline of like the value of like, I'm going to invest in this piece, I'm going to spend money to read the writing of this particular person about the thing that I'm interested in, does enormously take away from that. I mean, you know, I think maybe it's too soon to do the full post-mortem, but I do think there's been a degree of like There have been so many identity crises piled on top of identity crises in terms of what games media is over the years in different regards. I think a very difficult relationship between criticism and consumer advice, which are different things.
Yeah.
And the different ways that manifests itself. Trying to do both, kind of faltering attempts to achieve something more journalistic or more impressionistic and you know, all of in betweens. Like, I'm still not connected to it enough now, which is a strange thing to say, to know that there aren't still kind of attempts to play with the form. But I do think that, like, in a weird way, the underlying needs that sort of tricked people into reading games criticism have been so well addressed by, like, big, automated, heavy solutions and, like, Steam algorithms and stuff, that it's sort of taken the air out of the room. We can no longer trick people quite as easily into accidentally reading a piece of criticism, which will make them angry. and have them leave a horrible comment. Like, you just can't betray people's trust like that anymore. You just gotta, they are just gonna see whether they like a game or not from the wealth of information readily available for free on you can just watch someone play on YouTube and you just make your own mind up.
This question, got quite a lot of discussion going on the Discord, and I'm going to, at the end of this episode, I'll talk a little bit more about how we're changing up how we're doing questions to allow for more community engagement, just to give it the most Orwellian term possible. I more mean that it's nice to get other people's thoughts in on this stuff. And yeah, Somnolent Surfer was saying, you know, people who are referred to as games journalists would be better to be referred to as game critics, which is nothing wrong with, right? Cultural criticism is a good and valuable thing, he says, you know, which is
some of us a long time were games clowns, and I think that they mean that very seriously.
Yeah, I identify as a games journal because it was the parlance, but I was never really a serious journalist. I wasn't going out chasing stories. I mean, I did previews, I attended events, and I wrote them up in the way that journalists do, but I wasn't seeking news in the way that a news hound does.
Jason,
frontline reporting, you know, anything like that.
Jason Schreier is kind of an anomaly, right? Because he's been like building up a kind of pocketbook of contacts. You know, people talk about this on Discord too. Like, he's been building up that kind of the thing he does for years and years and years, with huge amounts, I'm sure, of time and investment put into kind of becoming the investigative journalist who's going to break the story about how this game went wrong, you know, or all the stuff. And he's literally writing a whole book on Blizzard now. And, like, I mean, like, there's huge amounts of people who've done that or did that for other forms of medium. So I assume there's going to be more of it. But it does seem like, things are changing so quickly. And there's people make games as well, which I think does, you know, really interesting work too. So there's stuff bubbling under, I think. But we're a ways to go yet before, we have the kind of coverage that we probably need.
I think it's interesting. Like, I guess it's limited and... I remember, like, the one or two times I took a serious attempt at investigative journalism while I was still writing. I still can't really talk about even in this medium, right? Like, off the record maybe, but, like, you still kind of end up in potential legal hot water. There's a lot of things that are quite tricky to navigate there without, like, really robust institutional support for the planning, the stories you're planning to break. And I think that is another reason why something to be aware of, I suppose, is that, you know, there's a compelling reason to not expose oneself to legal risk unless you're dead sure that you're right and dead sure that you have support in publishing or saying the thing that you believe that you've uncovered. It's also the case, I think, and I think this will come out more and more, that, like, and I've certainly kind of gained this impression in the years that I've now been on the other side of the fence longer than I was a journalist, which is kind of a weird thing to think about. Like, now it's as of this year, I think and I do think another interesting subject to dig into is that I do think that perceptions are really different on different sides of game stuff, like in terms of perceptions of the press and the role of the press and so on, and how reliably journalists surface what's really going on, also how common certain experiences are between studios and so on, and the sort of themes that run through the industry. And I think, like, there are there's both much more to be said about it, and also I think in the course of the journalism, even just like Jason Schreier is doing, or the people who make games are doing, you start to see a lot of the common themes, and it probably does help you assess like why decisions get made the way that they do, or why companies behave the way that they do. Often, you know, are come down to the same few realities, shall I say?
Yeah, and companies have already started kind of, you know, after the kind of reckoning over the last couple of years, you know, companies have started responding to that, and that wouldn't have happened, you know, in the same way without that work being done. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is a really important mechanism. I think it's also just like I think it is both reductive to say games criticism is a marketing vehicle for games. But it is also true that it's not necessarily the best delivery mechanism for exposés of poor working practices, for example. And I think like the conflation of those things for a long time has been kind of confusing. But a lot of this, I think, as I said at the top, a lot of this comes down to the fact that like we're probably trying to make the word journalist do too much.
I mean, there's lots of different kinds of journalists as well. Mm-hmm. It's a broad term. A journalist isn't just somebody who seeks and exposes hidden truths within industries. Like they can also be,
you know. There was a picture of Charlie Brooker in PC Zone eating his own ass after Carmageddon 2 didn't win Game of the Year. John Pilger? Woodward and Bernstein. Charlie Brooker eating his own ass.
Exactly. Any more questions? I think we could do one more. Land on a note other than Charlie Brooker eating his own ass.
That's all I think about. This is from David. David ran by email. Dear Saucy Semicolons, we recently had some cool days where I live, which can only mean one thing to me.
Oh, you mean like weather or like a cool day?
I had a cool day.
I saw a train. Like,
I was wearing a t-shirt with a picture of a sun that was wearing sunglasses on it, which can mean only one thing for me. It's time to play Dishonored. I associate the Dishonored series with October and November because the main entries released in those months. Last year, about this time, I replayed them and resolved every autumn I would play at least one of them. Do any of you have a game or kind of game you like to play during a certain time of year? Saucily yours, David.
No, if I'm honest, but I suppose I suppose there's a sort of ingrained in me through many holiday periods, there is a desire to play like a big, rich but shallow game over the course of Christmas. Like, you know, your big matinee adventure games, your Gods of War, your Uncharteds, they fit over a Christmas period as your...
You really want to shimmy along a well-marked ledge at Christmas.
Exactly. You know, not for much more than that after you've imbibed a Christmas pudding.
The Binding of Isaac is a roguelike top-down sort of Zelda game where you play as this little naked child who's crying tears to sort of defeat various manifestations of his childhood trauma and abuse, and everything's made of shit and tapeworms and horrible stuff like that. And I like to play that when I go home to my family's house for Christmas. Isaac is always a Christmassy game for me for those reasons.
I think I don't really have a tradition like this either, but last year I did. Christmas last year, it was my first kind of year at the Steam Deck, and I quite like treating it as like the great indie games I missed Amnesty Zone. So I think I played like Cocoon and Pentiment, and like, you know, sort of went through a bunch of things, and I think like that's a nice feeling, like catching up over a break. I think in terms of seasonality though, like I don't think I have a strict relationship. It's much more due to my work. It's much more down to my cycles of work and my general sort of mental state, I think, rather than what time of year it is. But I am determined to have a bit more of a chill autumn this year than I did last year. And so I think that what that does mean in real terms is more Baldur's Gate. But like, but that's less seasonal and more like I'm ready for a break. Therefore, it is time to keep just chipping away at different aspects of that massive game.
I can like, there's in like psychiatry, right? There's this idea of like early interventions for mental problems. So like, which is like, you know, if you can get in early, like you can stop someone getting depressed or having like some kind of breakdown because you can sort of spot these early warning signs. And like, I do this thing, right, where I'll install Destiny 2 on my PlayStation and I'll get all the bits of it I need. And I'll get it all set up and ready to rock. And then I'll play it for a couple of days. And then almost to the like decimal point of time, I will feel myself going into a slight depression. And I can literally now use the desire to play Destiny 2 as an early warning system to like, okay, I need to like make sure I'm taking my pills and like, you know, not schedule anything important. Then it's like the part of my brain which gets a chemical imbalance is the same part of my brain that wants to play Destiny 2.
I have exactly the same thing.
Oh my goodness.
Same game. The difference between us, Jamie, is that I have played 2,300 hours of Destiny 2. Although, actually, I've had, like, the longest... I mean, I think we were kind of in the pod hiatus when Destiny went through its recent big expansion and then subsequent layoffs at Bungie and stuff. And I have found myself in a strange hiatus recently where I haven't touched it in a couple of months, which is rare for me. I'd meaning to jump back in and play through the most recent seasonal stuff and things, but also the sort of... It kind of goes without saying, Bungie's had a few bad news cycles in a row and a lot of layoffs, and it's been quite kind of depressing. But that sort of, the sort of like, it's sort of lost its quality for me, at least recently, yeah. Is like this escapist place I could go. And it's been quite interesting that what surfaces in the absence of that go-to, like, this is the thing that I will be absorbed by, that will answer my brain's need for sort of something to think about, but not something that puts me under any pressure. And the answer, dare I say it, Peglin.
Peglin.
Every day I'm Peglin. That's...
They should make like Peglin like a fucking like crazy expansive like place where you go to like the Peglin Tower and jump around.
I will say it on this podcast. Will I do it? No. Will I say it out loud? Yeah. I will write the Peglin tie-in novel. I just finished a book. I can do this. I've got space in my schedule. I promise I wouldn't get another project going before the end of the year, but I think I could find a theme somewhere.
I'm imagining it would be like Finnegan's Wake, and it would all just be like made up like kind of your own like language.
A lot of orb puns.
Yeah, it's like
only in French.
If we're going there, it's like stately, plump Buck Mulligan hit loads of pegs on his way down the stairs. that's the second most middle-class joke I'll make on this podcast. James Joyce's Peggle. Nice.
I will. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Peggle.
I think it's a
portrait,
good
portrait of the orbist.
Dublin orbs.
Dublin.
Every Dublin. Bit is earthly erotic, as those books are.
Good.
Well, that's great to interact with the canon.
canon orb.
Good.
Yes, so that's all the questions we have the mental capacity for right now. We're going to do... You can still send questions to questions@quoteandcrowbar.com, but also on the Discord, our very lovely mods have now set up a questions forum. We're going back to forum, baby. It's PHP all over again, where you can submit your questions and we can track them a little bit easier. So hopefully that will be live by the time you hear this. And yeah, encourage everyone to get your questions in and get your discussions in as well, because it's nice to have more voices than just ours in there. Hey, check out Gold Teeth.
Oh,
it's Marsh's game. It's on Kickstarter, and a link for it will be in the show notes.
If you'd like to listen to more... More of this. There's more of this on createandcoroba.com, the website, which is where also you'll find links to the Discord, so on. There are video versions, but just pictures, but with sound. That's youtube.com/createandcoroba. We've got a Patreon still. You can find out details about supporting the podcast at patreon.com/createandcrowbar. And thank you very much to everybody that does so. And I believe that is all the additional context you require to fully assess whether or not you've enjoyed yourself.
If you want to know which games we're covering for the next episode, keep an eye on the Discord and I will announce that when we have decided upon them.
Fabulous. Well then, there's only one thing left for it.
Thanks
for listening, everybody. We said we weren't going to do that anymore, and we did anyway.
Yeah.
We can't stop. It's been 11 years.
If we stop, we'll die.